Hello, everybody. My name is Chris Messina. Today is Wednesday, August 11th, and this is the Tech Meme Ride Home Experience. The whole concept for the show was essentially I've been a longtime listener to the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast, which Brian hosts. And I'd find myself just kind of like walking around, especially during the pandemic, wanting to talk to someone about these stories. And it occurred to me, why don't I just talk to Brian himself? And so social audio happened to come along at the very right moment, and here we are. So essentially, we take some time to go deeper into the biggest, most interesting tech stories that are going on in the world. We try to bring on folks who know some things about these things. And on the one hand, put things into some historical context. We also talk about product context. We talk about the business models of this stuff. And we just try to like learn kind of what's happening, like what is going on in this world at the bleeding edge of tech. So that's the preamble. This topic today, specifically around the Galaxy Unfold and the Samsung event, I am actually going to plead my ignorance. I don't follow that space too closely, but this is something that Brian does and Sam specifically does.
No kidding, because it's unpacked. The event was unpacked, Chris.
And I just wanted to make sure that you guys saw in a very embarrassing public way how little I follow that space. So, it's like if I called it like, I don't know, like I'm not going to come up with something else. Anyways, you got the point. I'm going to let Brian and Sam take over.
Yeah, let me take the baton. And Sam, even though I'm making fun of Chris, today's event was all about flipping and folding. Let's just start out with your general impressions of the event today. We got a Flip 3, we got a Fold 3. Let's start with that, and then we can get into the other things around the margins.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of interesting that you say that, like, you don't have a lot of experience with foldables. And I think that was kind of the whole message of Samsung's entire event. This is the third Galaxy Fold, but, you'd be totally forgiven if you kind of wrote the first one off. That one had a bunch of issues. The second one made a lot of big, interesting steps, but now we have a third generation Galaxy Fold and then a new Galaxy Z Flip 3. And I think that, Samsung is really trying to push that, like, oh, hey, foldables are ready for the mainstream. Yes, they're still, wildly expensive, especially the Fold 3, but, they're like, oh, these things are usable. They have water resistance. The durability is improved. And that's kind of, really trying to make sure that people's like, oh, foldables aren't scary. They're usable, and there might be even some reasons, some very good reasons why you might want one.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. Like I actually, even though I do cover this all the time, I had forgotten that there was a difference between a fold and a flip, and I believe you have the fold, right? So first of all, just explain. Explain how Samsung has these two different devices and how they're slightly different, but then maybe what's new about these new ones.
Yeah, for sure. So the Galaxy Z Flip 3 is kind of their more mainstream phone. It's kind of like your old school flip phone, but modernized with modern flexible screen technology. And so that one, I think, that one in between being priced at $1,000, that one is like, oh, okay, it's kind of like, an interesting alternative to a traditional, glass slab smartphone. And the pricing makes it so that it's like, oh, but now you actually got to think about that choice if you're the kind of person who buys, premium phones. And then on the other hand, you have the Galaxy Z Fold 3, and that is their big screen. It's their power user phone. And, it's big, it's heavy, but if you really love big screen phones, you can't really find anything better. And then for this model, they added stylus support. So not only is it a big screen phone, also kind of a Galaxy Note replacement. So it's kind of bridging that really those kind of two audiences into something that is like a really, do everything device, unlike anything we've really seen before.
All right. I want to come back to your personal experience with the Fold. But in general, both of these are sort of iterative devices. Like there's not the Fold gets the S Pen support. I think they the screens got improved, there's water resistance or whatever, but essentially both of these phones are kind of like their previous gens, right?
Yeah, the designs are very similar to the previous generations. And like you said, it is iterative, but it's iterative in the way that you know, everything, it's like adding that extra layer of polish, because these devices were so new that there were just a lot of things that Samsung just simply wasn't going to know until people were able to use them in the wild. And now, two generations in, they're able to make, you know, a couple important upgrades in terms of just everyday usability. And I think that's, you know, partly what the previous models were missing.
The Flip, which is the one that is the Razer sort of clamshell, it flip, mm-hmm. because it reminds you of a flip phone of old. One interesting thing is that this is the first time that at least Samsung has got one of these foldable phones under $1,000. Are they the only ones? Are they the first to get a foldable phone under $1,000?
Yeah, and right now, and it just, you know, varies kind of depending on where you live, but especially in North America, the Flip is by far the cheapest foldable device, and it is the first one to get, like, really get under that, sneak in under that $1,000 price mark. And if you look over in China, there's the Huawei Mate X series, and Xiaomi has a couple things that they're working on that haven't released yet. But especially, you know, over in the West, Samsung is, you know, they have a three-generation lead on pretty much everybody else.
Obviously, we can't know this because they were just announced today in terms of the durability. You mentioned the durability and how they're learning mm-hmm. several generations in, but I'm going to reference your piece about living with one of these in a second, but the idea of having a crease and having, you know, air bubbles appear in between the screens and things like that. Do we know anything about what they've done for this generation to make the durability and those sorts of things go away?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously they added the IPX8 water resistance, so you can, you know, you can drop it into up to 5 feet of water for 30 minutes. And that right there is a big improvement in terms of, you know, just usability, because, you know, most premium phones today come with water resistance. And so that was, you know, a really important kind of tick in the box that Samsung had to do. But in terms of, like, durability, there's a new Armor aluminum. It's a Samsung's, you know, custom alloy that's supposed to be stronger on the hinge. The screen protector itself, they've switched from a TPU material to a PTE material, and they've made the adhesive for that factory-installed screen protector significantly stickier. So they're talking about 80% better durability. You know, obviously that's going to remain to be tested, and making sure that, you know, that screen protector does not come away, because that's, you know, what caused the bubbles on my personal fold too.
Do we know anything about the market penetration of foldables in terms of, and I'm not saying even worldwide, let's just say North America. And it used to be, I would know sort of anecdotally about these sort of things, because I'd be on the train every day and I'd see various phones in the world and things like that. But do we know if this lineup has been successful for Samsung specifically, or is this still experimental for them?
I think Samsung has been really cautious about releasing, you know, sales figures, especially when it comes to the foldables. So there's not a ton of information kind of available. But kind of like you were saying, I haven't seen anyone use one of these in the wild that wasn't like a YouTuber or in the tech media space. And so I think that kind of goes to show you that, to a certain extent, they haven't really penetrated it, and that's kind of what this, you know, they're really trying to make a statement about with this Unpacked event.
Yeah. So
actually, do you want to ask the audience, like, who here
raise your hand?
Use the little heart. Yeah, raise your hand. Give us some kind of emote. Give us a sense if you have a foldable or flip phone right now. And I'm seeing crickets.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that should be expected. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, but Sam, the reason that I reached out to you is because you did earlier this week write a piece about living with a foldable phone, which you said was a game changer with one terrible downside. So let me just specify that, and this is so confusing. I actually, even writing up today's show, I had a hard time distinguishing between the Flip and the Fold. You have the Fold 2. And the Fold is
I have the Fold 2.
The Fold is the one where if it's closed up, it looks like a candy bar. It's very tall. And then
It's like kind of like a long baton almost, like a TV remote with a screen on it.
Or a candy bar. Right. Yeah, yeah, right. And then but what this one has that the Flip doesn't. The Flip, again, looks like a old school razor and has a little tiny screen that will give you like notifications and stuff. But the Fold, in theory, you can use without opening because it has a front screen on the top that functions like a full smartphone slab of glass. Is that right?
Yeah. So on the outside of the device, there's what Samsung calls a cover screen, and it's basically an exterior screen. So that, I mean, the way it's kind of intended to use that, if you want to check, you know, notifications, respond to a text, you know, look up something in Google Maps or whatever, the exterior cover screen is able to like get you what you need to do quickly, and then you can go about your business. It's kind of like, you know, trying to make things really easy and simple. And so, you know, because opening up the phone is actually kind of a process. Like it's a two-handed operation. And so, you know, you don't always want to like sit there and like unfold something, especially if you're walking around the street.
That's 100% my question is that, as dumb as this may seem, if I say this out loud, it's like, how often would I really want to unfold my phone to use it? But in reality, if you think about it, you can see how it'd be like, God damn it. Do I have to open? I just want to see what that text is. I just want to respond. So question number one, you've been living with a Z Fold 2. How often do you find yourself opening it? And how often are you just leaving it closed and using it like anybody else uses a slab of glass?
Yeah. So the kind of the way I think about it is, if you're walking on the street or you're in a hurry or whatever, you just use that outside screen and you use it basically like any other phone. Where the, you know, that big interior screen comes into play is if you're, you know, commuting on the subway, if you're, you know, watching a movie in bed, or even just like, you know, sitting on the couch, having that extra screen real estate makes browsing everything just so much better. Or playing games or everything. So it's really just like kind of two modes. There's the quick on the go mode, and that's the outside cover screen. And there's the, oh, I want to enjoy something. I want to like kind of sink my teeth into some content, whatever it is. And that's when that big screen really comes into play.
Okay, but that, I'm going to ask it a kind of slightly different way, but the same question, which is like, my phone's sitting on my desk in front of me right now. And so I wouldn't be opening it up to do something. Like, if you, in your average day, are you opening it 30% of the time, 50% of the time?
I'm going to say 50% of the time.
Interesting. Because it's that,
it's really that balanced in terms of, and obviously, you know, it depends on what you're doing that day, but you know, there are definitely times where like, or even like I'll check something, or like I'll be scrolling through Twitter and I see like a funny video and I'm like, oh, I want to see that. And then I'll open up the phone. And so it's like, it's kind of dynamic in that way where it changes the way it operates based on what you want to do.
You know, I will say, just to jump in here, because that is a use case that I think is relevant, or at least a behavior where half the time I'll see emails or I'll see things that are just kind of like somewhat larger tasks where I do want the bigger screen. And I'm kind of like, you know, even though I've got like an iPhone Pro 11 Max or whatever, probably got that one wrong too. There's still moments where I want to have like more screen real estate. So I can imagine actually having that in the device itself and being able to expand in situ kind of allows you to drive through and you know, I'm so distractible that by the time I get to my big screen, I'm like, what was I even doing? And like, oh, look, Twitter. So I can imagine that actually might actually increase your productivity to some extent. I guess, is that your experience of it? And by the way, I also just want to remind everyone that I am pinning tweets that are, you know, sharing related content or reviews or things like that too, as we're going. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm not going to say I'm more productive on this thing because this, like the Fold to me is like the ultimate time waster because it makes every distraction way more interesting.
Interesting.
But, you know, I have used it at trade shows and stuff like that. And, you know, being able to multitask and just having like side-by-side apps where I can, you know, check a calendar and then check an email to make sure like, hey, am I going to the right place or whatever? I think that is supremely useful. Absolutely.
That's one of the things that they were saying was even improved today, is like, you know, tiling around various things so you can have multiple things running at the same time. But go ahead, Chris.
Well, you got a faster screen refresh rate and things like that. Yeah. I guess like the question is, you know, with this event and with all the press around it, do you think Samsung achieved what they set out to do? In other words, to convince people that, you know, a fold or a folding device or a flip phone is both sufficiently differentiated and more appropriate for the given use cases relative to a flat slab of, you know, glass and metal.
Yeah, for sure. I think in terms of the fold, that price is still going to put out of reach of pretty much everybody. Yeah. You know, you have to be like a bleeding edge enthusiast to like say, I'm going to willingly spend $1,800 on a phone, whatever.
Yeah.
As when it comes to the flip, I think that is much more interesting because it's like, I mean, if you look around the space, that's might be the most stylish phone on the market now. Oh, they did a really good job with the cases, with the colors.
Great. It looks great.
And they even have the case with like the elastic band on the back. So it's like, it kind of brings in a little bit of utility and like, you know, it's better looking than a pop socket. And so I think the style play is a really interesting angle from Samsung. And then combined with that, with making it basically the same price as, you know, an iPhone 12 Pro or whatever, then you're like, oh man, I can have something that looks really cool and it does everything I wanted to do normally. And that, I think that's a really interesting kind of conundrum.
Final question-ish, with the caveat that we don't know how much this has been improved, but you mentioned in your living with a foldable phone that you have been living with a crease and things like that. How much does that bug you in day-to-day driving?
The crease bugs me about 0%. If you look at it straight on, you don't see the crease. It's only if you look at it from like, you know, side angles, you actually notice the crease. And to me, like, I honestly don't even see the crease anymore. Now, as it comes to like the bubbling, you know, I've had the phone for about 9-10 months, and you know, because the screen protector is kind of peeled away, air bubbles just get trapped in there. It's a daily battle where I'm constantly like smoothing out the screen, pushing out the bubbles, and it's really annoying. And I said this back when I reviewed this, and it's like I was worried that this was going to happen, and it did. And so I think, you know, that was one of the things that Samsung worked to improve. And it's like those little details that like you don't really think much about in the beginning, and then it becomes like, oh, this is just really annoying on a daily basis. And I think that's what they, you know, were really trying to address in part with the new devices.
That sounds horrible, by the way. Like a laminated device that like gets bubbles, like
right. And so I have to be kind of specific when I talk about this, because technically, you can remove the screen protector, and that would solve all of my problems in 10 seconds. Now you know, if you go right, well, and if you go back to the Galaxy Fold 1, when people did that, they just ruined the screen because right. It was a completely different construction. And so for this one, like, you know, Samsung was really careful to warn people, hey, you can take it off, but if you do it, we strongly recommend you take it to a service center. And, you know, so I tried to play by Samsung's rules. I tried to, you know, abide by all their guidelines and stuff. And it just doesn't work because, you know, after 6 months or so, you know, I wanted to take it apart, but or take the screen protector off. But, you know, it was the middle of the pandemic. Like, it doesn't make sense to go out to a Samsung service center, which there aren't a ton of, or maybe a Best Buy. And then just to get a screen protector replaced, that's something that people have kind of gotten accustomed to doing at home. And so that it was definitely frustrating. But, you know, I had talked to other people, other Fold users who took the screen protector off, and they said that they haven't had any issues. But, you know, if you, you know, that's not, Samsung would really prefer you not to.
Well, I guess we can look forward to, what would it be, 2023, when the iPhone gets a foldable or something. But
yeah. I mean, in some ways, Apple's smart because they're kind of sitting back and watching Samsung kind of navigate the early stages of foldable devices. And this is like what Apple has been really good at throughout the years, is they let people kind of test the waters, and then they swoop in, you know, a couple generations in and like, oh, here's our device. And it doesn't have any of the issues because we didn't make, you know, we didn't try this before, you know, people thought it was ready, or, you know, before they felt that, you know, the device was in a proper proper state for the masses.
Got it. All right, Sam, really appreciate you coming on. Really appreciate your experience, kind of at least educating me on this whole space. I did a little bit of digging, I got to say this, like today, and I learned a lot more about it. And I was actually impressed, by the look of these things, by the functionality that could be there. I think you're right. The price point, it just makes it a little bit, you're not going to really experiment. Like you got to be either, got crypto, billions or, just, I guess, looking for that extra productivity boost or something. But really helpful putting this all in context for us. So thanks for coming on today.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Feel free to stick around. I wanted to, bring this up as it's not even, actually it is. It's a bit of a segue. Today, Twitter launched a new font. And of course, it sort of broke the internet and the places where people talk about and kvetch about things that they see and that they weren't consulted on. And it's so, it's crazy, right? Like, I will admit that I do this, and I probably shouldn't admit this because now everyone who I work with is going to know that I'm the culprit. But oftentimes I will go into like Google Docs and I will select all and I will change the font, usually to something like Work Sans, totally appropriate, very tasteful, of course, which is my taste. And then I'll go into the styles and I'll change normal to the normal text to have the new font, and then everything cascades. And I'm sure everyone just like gets really, really upset with me. But they don't know, at least until now, that I'm the one who does that. And so I feel like Twitter kind of just did that to like most of the internet. And I like the Chirp typeface. It's a little bit like Franklin Gothic. It's its own thing. There are areas where, at least on the website, the font hasn't totally rolled out, but it does. It looks and it feels different. It's sharp and it's bright, especially on Retina displays. And I'm curious if if I'm going to notice that feel, just as I have with San Francisco, which is the typeface that Apple uses, when I'm spending time in Twitter properties. It doesn't seem to have rolled out on the desktop app yet, though. And what was the other thing I was going to say about it? This is probably boring to people who don't follow this stuff. But
I can't see it on TweetDeck. And also, it's like...
TweetDeck. Rip TweetDeck. I mean, you've got to be using the beta. Like, the TweetDeck's going away.
Well, right, but listen, I use what I use. But also, I'm also... You know how there's people that, like, can't hear... can't hear tunes or something like that. Like,
I see. They're like font blind.
I'm kind of. I'm a little bit design blind. I wouldn't even say font blind. I'd be like, you could change a whole bunch of stuff to me, and
you're like, you're like, they changed it. What am I? What does this have to
exactly?
Do with
yeah, me? Yeah.
Like, I don't see it. I'm like, look at the ligatures. Look at the, you're like, I don't get it. Anyways, it was a big deal to me, and I saw it, and I see you Twitter, and like they've been doing a lot of stuff, and I remember I'll bring this one last anecdote up. This is a very, this is interesting to me, but I don't know if anybody else cares. But when I was at Google, and I was working at Google Plus, we also tried to design our own font. And I believe that font was called Open Sans. Now, ironically, Open Sans, and I was a big open source advocate for a long time, was not actually that open. In fact, there was some dispute with the typeface company that designed it that they wanted to be paid for like every single install or something. And, think about a web font. And think about Google Scale, and every time the font gets downloaded, that company gets paid. I mean, that's a really, really great business, but Google was like, uh-uh. So that's actually how Roboto came along, is that they ended up doing it internally. They commissioned their own font, so they would have their own look and feel, and that's one of the things that sort of got the whole web font thing going. But I found that to be very interesting. That was going to be part of the Google Plus, like, design, brand, voice, and all this stuff. So I understand the both business cost of putting out a font, of designing your font, the cost that goes into it, and just the weight in not using a system font. But we're moving forward with the web. It's coming, the design's getting improved, et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, so hats off to that team. Hopefully they're going to go off and spend some time with some lead type or something tonight, and have a good time. Okay, the reason why that's sort of a segue is because this is not something, Brian, you brought up. I don't even know if it made it to TechBeam today, but I did see it trending on Twitter, which is that 1Password announced, and I think this actually happened a couple days ago, but it just hit my transom today, that they are opening up their early access program for 1Password 8. Now, 1Password, as I'm sure many people are familiar with it, but it is the number one password, as a word altogether. That's the brand name. And it is essentially a password manager. Now, I went back into my email archives and I found that my very first email with Dave Tehr, the CEO of 1Password, back when he was running a company called Agile Web Solutions, so he was like early days of Agile, was from 2006. And in 2006, I sent him an email and I was like, hey, I think you should add support for OpenID into 1Password. So I've been a user of this product for a very long time. I have to say, I was not successful in convincing them to adopt OpenID. And of course, OpenID has not really taken the web by storm as we had once hoped. But regardless, 1Password did not only succeed, but stick around. They announced a $100 million investment from Accel Partners back in July to really blow this thing up. And so,
which I didn't cover, but I really almost, I would have if it hadn't been a busy day. Like, because I live with 1Password and everything I do all the time.
Yeah, well, so why don't, you know, I want to bring up some folks today from the 1Password team. We actually have a bunch of folks here. I reached out to them because I was like, hey, you know, I'm sort of like dunking on this and lots of people are dunking on this because of a number of either ways of communicating or messaging, or just, again, you know, it's just like changing the fonts. Like, there are some changes and people are afraid and they're scared. And so therefore people have expressed that concern. Brian, but why don't you tell us a little bit about how you use 1Password so people sort of understand, you know, what that experience is, what that product is. And then we'll bring this up and talk about sort of these changes and what's happening next.
I mean, we keep talking about, Chris, we're going to do an episode one time where we talk about how we do our workflows and things like that. But yeah, I mean,
it's going to be a ticketed space. That's what we're going to do. We're going to sell tickets for that.
I feel like over a decade now, I've been using 1Password, and it's like, you know, it was early days of me trying to be secure in what I did on the internet. And this is me not doing an ad for them. This is me, like, literally, you know, every single login that I have has a different password. And then when they integrated it with the iPhone, that was insanely great. And so, yeah, I mean, every time I go to any website, I log in with 1Password. When it's on the phone, I just do the same thing, and it opens with Face ID. They integrated what would you call it? The two-factor authentication, where it's the code.
OTP.
Oh, yeah, OTP. Yep. Right, exactly. So, I mean, it's just, it just gets better and better and better. And, you know, I'm now paying for it on a yearly basis, but I'm happy to. It's one of those things that is so fundamental to everything that I do that it's fine. How do you make a password that's strong enough so no one will guess it, and it's impossible for you to forget, and do it for 100 different sites, and make it so everyone in your company can do the same without ever needing to reset them? Sounds impossible unless you have 1Password. More than any other product I've ever told you about, I can vouch 1,000% for 1Password. I can't live without it. 1Password makes strong security easy for your people and gives you the visibility you need to take action when you need to. Any device, anytime, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else: your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. 1Password's award-winning password manager is trusted by millions of users and over 100,000 businesses, from IBM to Slack. It beat out 40 other options to become Wirecutter's top pick for password managers. Right now, my listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/ride for your growing business. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/ride. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/ride.
It's fine. Is that your word?
It's fine in the way that you pay for everything that makes function.
You're satisfied and not angry.
I'm okay. If that sounded bad, no. I'm saying I love 1Password. I'm happy to pay. And then what I need you to do is explain to me what this new change is that people are up in arms about.
Well, like I said, we've got Rustam, and we got Michael here to sort of like help us to, you know, go through this and understand this. We got folks from the team. I will give you my impression. I pinned my tweet, which is part of I'll explain how this happened and how I don't know. I was on Twitter a lot today, just ogling at the font, the new typeface. And I saw this guy, Cinder, who's a prolific Mac developer, basically say, oh, I think I should go, what did he say? He said, I'm really thinking about going and creating my own open source password manager. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I use a lot of his apps. I'm like, that's cool, right? It seemed like a totally benign thing to say. And then a couple tweets later, I saw someone else's tweet. Oh, this guy, Curtis Hebert or Herbert at Parrots, where he, I guess, downloaded the 1Password 8 binary, took a look inside and realized that this was no longer a native Mac app, but was actually an Electron app. And for folks who have used Electron apps, they typically are pretty resource intensive. They tend to be slow. They tend to it's like basically running a browser as an application. And if your browser is already slow, now you've got dozens of browsers that are all running as separate instances because of the way that platform and system works. And so instantly, for me, I was like, oh, this is terrible. And the reason why this is happening, and again, this is all extrapolation, and that's why we're having this conversation, was because, they raised all this money and now they've got to be cross-platform. They're no longer true to their Mac, roots, and, they're abandoning us. And it's another example of how the world is going to hell, et cetera, and so forth. And so that was sort of my initial, response. And then I was like, well, let me take a step back. There's reasons and yada, yada. And so, anyways, I would love to be, told how I've got it wrong and what's really going on here. So I will step back and let the folks with 1Password tell us more.
Hey, Chris. This is Rustam.
Hey, man.
One of the founders of 1Password. And I remember the first time we met in San Francisco.
Yep.
And then I think at some point you mentioned that you have over 10,000 items stored in 1Password.
Uh-huh. Oh, right. That was my problem. I was stress testing the limits of this thing. I'm going to see how many I have right now, because I probably have way more than 10,000.
And that was crazy. I use every time our people on our team tell us that the performance is fine, I'm like, we have a user that has over 10,000 items in 1Password.
You weirdo, Chris. You weirdo.
I know. I'm sorry. Right now, I only have 6,539 items, and that's across 10 vaults. So I don't know. It's
much more reasonable.
Which we should say, it's not just passwords because, right, there's secure notes. Is that what it is, Chris? Because, I save all sorts of secure notes in there for, my...
No, it's mostly passwords. I mean, this will tell you my scar tissue. This is why I am such a, weird OCD person. I mean, if you go all the way back to the early days when I was taking screenshots of things and posting it to Flickr, I tried every goddamn app that came out. And when, before OpenID and before Google Authentication, you would, use mostly the same password everywhere until a password manager came along and allowed you to, change your password and not use the same password everywhere. And then you needed a place to record all those passwords, hence 1Password, hence the proliferation of all those sign-ins. So yes, I use many of the features, including, I've got password information and address information. I've got Wi-Fi passwords. I imported my keychain at one point back when there was a separation. I don't know. Before 1Password actually used a keychain to store the information, and then somehow that changed. Anyways, I have a lot of credentials.
Yeah, so I think that's probably more than any other 1Password user. but you just downloaded the 1Password 8, right, as well today?
I
saw your screenshots, so that was pretty nice. How was it? Was it fast for you? Did you see any performance issues there?
I haven't gone too deep with it yet. I did sign in. I will, this is not going to be a therapy session for me necessarily, or I don't want it to be, but I will say that let me set this up a little bit. I have resisted the whole subscription software kind of migration as heavily as I could, and I keep falling. I feel like, it's just like a million tiny, red ants kind of eating my feet, and eventually I just kind of give in and I die. And 1Password was one of those where I switched browsers. Chrome had gotten so slow and so bloated for me or whatever, and I found a browser called Sidekick. And I, of course, migrated my extensions and all the rest. And Sidekick is built on Chromium, so, it should have been a clear migration. But when it came to 1Password, and this is a security feature, actually, the 1Password extension didn't work with Sidekick because it wasn't signed to work with that browser. So right. It would have been insecure, essentially, to work with any random browser because, blah, 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 I'm not going to get into the details. And so I had to switch to a 1Password X membership, which was the new version of the extension, in order to use it with Sidekick. And so that's when you finally got me to switch over to be a subscriber. And so now that I've downloaded 1Password X, you guys are in this interesting kind of liminal phase, as Sketch is, for example, of moving from, you buy a license, you own the software. If you want to upgrade to the next version, you buy the next license, versus now it's more of a subscription. So I guess to try to answer your question, I haven't gone too deep with it, but I feel like as a result of using more and more of the web-based and cloud-based features of 1Password, I'm going to notice how performant, you know, it is. And especially, I don't know if you guys have what the plans are for being cross-platform.
Well, it's interesting, and we could argue what is native and what is not. But to be honest, sure. For me, performance is very, very important. And
yep.
I actually tested the native and quote-unquote unnative one password side by side. And the version that we have right now is faster. Like the UI-wise, things that I can do there are faster.
And how do you achieve that? Like let's talk a little bit about like what's working in your favor. Because one of the things that I heard you guys talk about before is that, you know, you've moved over to Rust. And, you know, I don't know. Also, like software, especially as complex as a product like 1Password, develops just a lot of kind of cruft and stuff over time, you know, unless you've rewritten it recently. And my sense is that 1Password has a lot of old code that goes way back. And so this opportunity with 1Password 8 really was an opportunity to move really to a web front end and a stronger kind of foundational core. And so that gives you some of the new web architecture stuff to speed up the front end. Is that accurate, or am I getting that wrong?
Can I jump in, Rustin?
Just a sec. I want to say that we did rewrite 1Password in the past a few times, and I think it was always a very painful experience, and it always involved a lot of work. So people should not rewrite their software, right? But I think in this case it was justified, and I let Michael to tell you why.
Okay, Michael, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Michael Fay. I'm the VP of Engineering for the client apps here at 1Password.
Nice.
And thanks, by the way. Chris, thanks for having us. This is cool. I mean, I had to learn what a Twitter space was, but once I got that sorted, like, this is great. So there's this story that I have that I sort of tell to everybody that I interview to come join my team, and it's that, you know, if you go back to the beginning of 1Password, it started as, you know, Dave and Rustem built this thing in a cave out of spare parts, you know, way back when as a Mac app, right? And it was they built it to solve a problem that they were having as they were developing websites, which was Rustem and Dave were building sign-in forms and contact forms and had to keep typing stuff in. And they were like, we can just write an app that does this for us. This is ridiculous. We'll do that. We'll take a weekend. We'll do that. We'll put it up on some, you know, version tracker and Mac update, and then we'll get back to work. And of course, you know, it blew up and it went from there. So started as a Mac app. When the iPhone SDK came out, it became an iPhone app. We hired a Windows developer and an Android developer at some point along the way, and literally like one of each, and said, hey, like, here's what the iPhone app looks like. Here's what the Mac app looks like. Like, go ahead. Like, go build yourself a 1Password app. And here's some, you know, here's a designer that could help you with some of it. And we sort of went, and we had separate teams that were building all of our apps and building them in parallel. And at the time, like we were using Dropbox to sync your data, or we were using iCloud if you were on Apple platforms. And that was fine, and it worked well. And we, you know, certainly had a lot of success there because we're still here today. But even when I was running the Apple team a few years ago, I would find out stuff that the Windows team did, like when I read about it on our blog, right? Like I'd be like, oh, that's cool. Like the Windows team added this new feature.
Anyway, how many people are we talking about, by the way? Like how big are these teams?
Like 5 people each.
Oh, okay. So like a big coordination problem.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. No, it certainly, it shouldn't have been, but
right.
Nonetheless, like we were all independent. Like, you know, we were like that. We've got our roadmap. We're building our cool features. The other teams are building their cool features. No big deal. And if one of the other teams added a feature that we thought was cool, like we'd go and build it, but we'd do it from scratch and do it our own way, right? And make our own thing. And so we ended up in this space where we just had separate teams building separate things, even though they were all 1Password apps. And even when we introduced, like 6 years ago, when we introduced 1Password.com, we still built the support for the service into the client apps separately. And so we had effectively four or five full implementations from back end to front end of a 1Password app, and including the communication, all the code and all the logic and everything for communicating with the server. And we tried to do a much better job of sort of documenting the APIs and documenting the database structures and everything. And still we ended up with differences among the clients that when it came time to change things, you know, our server lead would come to us and say, hey, like, it's time to add this new feature to your apps. When can you get this to us? And myself and every other platform lead would say the same thing, which was like, I don't know, man, like, now's not a good time. I'm busy. Like, maybe in a few weeks. And like, everybody's few weeks was different than everybody else's few weeks. And it just started to paralyze us. Like, we couldn't move. We were so excited to have a service, but like, we couldn't move fast to save our lives because, you know, like I said, different code stacks. So we said, all right, let's time out. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, let's take a step back. And so we started to look at options for creating a shared code library, a backend.
Wait, so when was this?
Oh, sorry.
When did you
this
have this?
This was 2-3 years ago, 2.5 years ago.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. We did have a false start where we sort of like tried a thing. It didn't work out. And then we had to sort of stop and start over.
We've used multiple languages to say that.
Yeah.
And learn new things along the way.
Yes. Right. So, and I won't go into all the super details of that, but at a certain point, like, so in earnest, back at the end of 2019, leading into 2020, we started to build this backend common, what ended up being the 1Password core, which is just, it's a headless 1Password app, right? It encapsulates all the logic of what makes a 1Password app a 1Password app. So everything about the cryptography, everything about communicating with the server, the database code, the logic for enforcing permissions up to the front end that says, like, this person can edit an item, but this person's in read-only mode. All of that stuff lives in one spot. And the goal being that if we consolidate bulk of the 1Password app into one spot, then when it comes time for the server team to tell us, hey, look, we're making a change, cool, we can have one person potentially go and make that change, and we redeploy that to all of our apps at the same time. And so that's where we did a thing that you're never supposed to do in software, which is we rebooted all of our apps. We hit file new project on five platforms effectively, right? Like, we said, okay, we're going to build we're going to build a Linux app because we've had customers asking for that for 10 years now. So we think we can build a Linux app. Let's go do that. And we're definitely going to build a new Windows app. So let's do that. We're going to build a new Mac app. And in fact, we sort of said we're going to build two new Mac apps, and I'll get to that in a second. We're going to build an iOS app. We're going to build an Android app. But since they're all based on this core, we can have these thin UI wrappers around the bulk of the 1Password, like this headless 1Password app. And it should be easy to build. We should be able to move pretty quickly. We should be able to get these out the door and move on. And now we've reset. So that as we go forward, when we want to build new features and solve new problems and stuff, we have this incredibly strong base to do this on. So what you're seeing now with the launch of 1Password for Linux back in May, the 1Password for Windows early access June, and then today's 1Password early access for Mac, these are the first three of the new core apps. What you're going to see next is 1Password for iOS and 1Password for Android, also built on top of the core. And those are going to complete like the first phase of our rewrite here. So that's sort of like where we've been and where we've gotten to so far and a little bit of where we're going. So I'll pause there for questions.
I mean, thank you. That's an amazing just chronology in terms of where you guys have been. I had many questions as you were kind of walking us through that. You know, I think one of them is in some ways, I don't know, like the growth of 1Password is one of these kind of obvious things in retrospect. And I suppose maybe I'm a little bit too close to it because I've worked in the identity space for a long time and, you know, saw the promise of one login, you know, from way, way back in the day. And our whole sort of reason for being was to destroy the password. And it just turns out the password is far too useful and far too straightforward. And, you know, as the guy that came up with the hashtag, like, I should have known that and known better that a more complicated solution, even if it's more secure, ultimately would probably not take off given all the, you know, second order effects that a single sign on, you know, incurs. You know, just, I mean, for example, and one of the thoughts that I had, actually, I think this is a big one from an architectural perspective, is that 1Password used to sort of exist on your personal machine. And, you know, eventually, yes, you added syncing through Dropbox, And that actually was a really big deal. And I feel like Dropbox and 1Password kind of lived together, because you'd sort of get to a new computer or you'd have your work laptop and you'd sort of sync your 1Password folder. And that was one way of kind of keeping your life, your digital life, kind of consistent across these places. My question, I guess, is about when you started to move into building up the web services side of this, because that never felt like it was part of the 1Password. And now it feels like it's an essential part of what 1Password is becoming, just as everything else is moving to the cloud and we're dealing with thin clients. So help me understand that, because one of the big architectural changes, and I've discovered this in my own life, as I have gotten my partner onto 1Password, now she and I have a shared vault, and adding social to any software makes it infinitely more complex. So I understand the aspect of building client software, but walk me through the journey of how, like, you know, the cloud and, you know, building more web software became part of what you're doing. Because I think that story actually is similar to other Mac developers and their journey as well.
Yeah. So I love this aspect of our history a little bit, because that change from standalone vaults that you could opt in to sync over Dropbox or iCloud to having a hosted service was something that we struggled with for a while, and not struggled with like as a moral quandary, but struggled with from a technical point of view,
100%.
Because we knew that the strength of 1Password was that not just in sort of the strength of the cryptography and everything else, but there was real strength in the fact that there was no one central repository for everyone's data. And
perspective. Yeah, yes, exactly. Like,
exactly. Right. And as soon as we became a hosted service, we're a honeypot, right?
Exactly.
We have one spot we can go, or someone can go, to just get everybody's data.
You're like the Mount Gox of passwords, or you don't want to become that, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So like we, before we even wrote like a single line of code for the new hosted service, we said like, we got to solve this problem. Like we cannot be a honeypot for these people. And so, our security team is absolutely brilliant. They came up with this concept of the secret key. So basically, you take your password, and you take this long randomized string of digits, and you slap them together. It encrypts your data to such a high degree that it's computationally infeasible that anyone could ever break into it. Right?
We sort of have this actual use case of quantum computing, which, you know, we'll never get here. So we're fine.
Yeah. I mean, we had this idea that like, we should be able to take our database of customer data and just put it up on GitHub, right? Like, just go ahead. Like, go ahead. Anyone can download this thing and try your best, and it would never matter. That was the bar that we wanted to reach for the security that we had. So, and the account password plus secret key got us to that point. So great. Like, we solved that aspect. The other thing that, of course, that's always made us...
So to be clear, really, you did actually achieve that level of security.
And we did.
All of our passwords are not all on GitHub.
No, your passwords are not on GitHub. Yeah, I want to be super, super
Just want to make sure.
Here.
Yep, don't want to leave that ambiguous. Oh. Okay.
It was a benchmark we wanted to hit, but like, obviously not the only level of security.
Doesn't need to be tested,
like,
but that was the benchmark. Okay.
Yeah. And so the other thing that's always made us a really strong offering is the fact that like your data is on your local device, and we didn't want to have a service where you had to be online to go get your stuff, right? So in many ways, like the 1Password apps connected to the 1Password.com service are really no different than they've ever been. Like, it downloads your data locally. It's stored locally on your device. It's encrypted on your device. It's transmitted back up to the service, fully encrypted and everything else. But like, if you're on a train going through a tunnel, you can pull up all your data and pull out a password or pull out your passport or anything else. So yes, we have a hosted service, but it's not in sort of the traditional like live access to your data only when you're connected to the internet type experience. But it also enables us to do things like you were talking about with you and your significant other, that you've got shared data now, right? Like, I have a vault for me and my wife that's like where everything goes. And it's so great to just be like, do you I don't know the kids' social security numbers. Like, all right, well, I have them. She has them. Like, everyone has everyone's ever social security number. So, like, simple use cases like that are so much more powerful now And if we were still sort of in the old model, it just wouldn't have ever scaled, because you fine for two people maybe, but like you get up to a team of 10, what, like really, like you're looking at conflict resolution. Like it's a real mess. So it's been a huge win in that regard. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Brian has a question.
Yeah. Well, by the way, I need to turn on that shared thing with my wife. Although to this day, we
still... God, you don't have that. Wait. Let me pause before you jump into this, because this is, it's not only like a game changer, but it's like a relationship saver. And well, it's at least, hold on, let me finish.
Yeah.
Or it's a relationship destroyer. That's also possible. But one of the challenges with security is getting people who are not in the space and don't really know how to assess the risk of their digital footprint or their digital experience to adopt these things. And so I found that when I created this shared, and I actually used Dropbox to do the syncing, the shared folder with, it's called a vault, it allowed my partner to basically get much more protection and, you know, sharing secure credentials than what she was doing before, which, you know, like many people do, is to reuse the same password in many places, or to have a series of three or four passwords that they reuse. And then they will share them amongst their family members and everyone remembers it. And then they start using those and they propagate it like a virus. And so what this allowed for was to essentially teach someone how to use a password generator that's going to create something that's more secure, that's not memorable, but have a place to store it. And then to use that in multiple places. So I just want to point this out, because I did not understand this use case previously, and it's one that I think has really, really improved at least my sense of overall security and my partner's.
Well, and I was going to say we've been married 10 years and we still have separate bank accounts and separate credit cards. So there's a lot of things that we haven't joined. But speaking of that, like, you know, we were just talking about like kids' social security numbers, like those are the secure notes and things like that, or even just like filling in credit cards, like
even just kids having passwords, you know?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
How do you get them to like use something that's secure?
Well, our kids aren't old enough that if they have to log into something, I got to do it for them. But all right. I'm sorry. I'm hemming and hawing to Chris. Chris asks the
product. Ask your question.
The product questions. I ask the business questions. And I don't know who wants to take this one. But last month, when your latest round was announced, I believe you guys announced that you had like 90,000 business customers at this point. To what degree have you guys up until this point been consumer facing, and to what degree is sort of the business side of it, the enterprise side of it, maybe the future for y'all?
It's something that as we've grown, we talk a lot about, like, who is 1Password for? And one of the core tenets that we keep coming back to is like, 1Password's for everyone, right? At the same time, we look at sort of where we have, as a company, we think we have the most growth to do. And we really have a big opportunity, we think, in the business space. And so we're taking some opportunities to move more into that space and try and tackle some of the problems that we think we can solve in the business space. And you've seen that, well, you maybe have seen that in some of the recent announcements we had earlier this year. We launched a product called Secrets Automation. It's basically 1Password for cloud services, right? So now, and it integrates in with normal 1Password, such that like you could go and set up an Amazon web service and use 1Password to provide the passwords for it, or provide tokens for it, and know that those passwords, those tokens, are stored securely in 1Password, and it's all managed, and you can go and roll those keys. Like if someone, let's say that someone leaves a company that had been managing these keys for you, like a company can just be like, all right, cool, like I'll just roll those tokens, that person is gone, they don't have access to this anymore. So like we're moving beyond individual password management in that way, but it is all additive, right? It's not at the expense of still providing the experiences and the solutions that we need for customers that are, you know, a family or an individual or a small team, right?
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months. Or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Indeed. To what degree, though, I've done a couple stories recently about the big platforms all saying that they're going to kill passwords, Microsoft saying it, Google saying, everyone's saying it, and we're moving in theory towards a future where it's, you know, biometrics and things like that. A company with the name password in the name, you guys still see a space and a use case for y'all in a future biometric world?
So yes, like one of the cool things about, so first of all, yes, like I think that it would be ignorant of me to say, like, don't worry, like, that's all a bunch of bunk. Like, that's never going to happen. Like, no, certainly not.
Hey, I think we're all looking forward to it. I think it would be great if you don't have to worry about the passwords at all. Right?
Yes. Much more concise than I was going to say. Yes. The technologies that are being proposed to do these things, like, we're excited about. And looking at ways that we can adopt them so that we, like, 1Password could become potentially a passwordless option, right? Like, okay, cool. Like, we're all in on this future because we think that it's the best way to go for.
I mean, you functionally are for me already anyway. I have no idea what any of my passwords are. Like, so it doesn't really matter. It's just the click of a.
This is true.
Yeah.
And integrated with password autofill on iOS, right? Like you're signing in using your face and stuff is just working. Yeah.
One of the questions I think is also like where this goes, because I think having been so intimately familiar both with like your history and with the evolution of authentication on the web and the increasing places where it's not just authentication, you know, it is authorization and access. And increasingly, you know, now the world that I'm in the fintech space, there's KYC, which is Know Your Customer, which requires increasing levels of authentication with different, you know, providers like the government and things like that. I'm sort of reaching a little bit, but I am curious, like, how you guys think about this, because I think it's important to think about where this goes, which, you know, right now, obviously, we're in this very interesting moment when, in order to go out to many places in the world, you're going to need to have some sort of proof that you've been vaccinated. And 1Password sits in this very interesting place, you know, where you guys could provide at least the underpinnings of or the access to. As far as I know, there's no way for me to add vaccination or proof of vaccination as a type of information to 1Password. Or am I mistaken about that?
You are mistaken. We did add a medical record type.
Okay.
It is a place to store your personal information. It does not act as any official government document or anything.
So I think that's part of my question, right? Like, on the one hand, there's the storing of the secrets. And then there's the using them in different contexts. And increasingly, at least Apple seems to be, you know, we had this earlier conversation about what Samsung's doing, but I feel like Samsung, at least in my impression of those devices, aren't really thinking about the way in which people become somewhat more merged with their technology, I guess. And what I mean by that is I'm thinking about how I can use my Clipper card in San Francisco to, you know, go and get on the subway by just waving my phone, you know, or my watch over the turnstile. And so 1Password has access to a bunch of these credentials that I would want to use in lots of different circumstances. So to what degree do you see an opportunity maybe to either provide leadership in that space or to store some of that information and then to be able to replay it in different contexts? Or do you simply want to kind of like be the place where the secrets are stored and that's your business?
So we're always, it's like you've been hanging out in some of our Slack channels. Like, this is so fun. this is a type of thing that we talk about a lot, is sort of like, how do we take that data that people do store in 1Password and make it more actionable? And it's a tricky proposition in a lot of ways, because the thing, you know, the behaviors that you were talking about, using your phone to just, you know, get on the subway and stuff, like, yes, absolutely. Like, that's something that an integrated hardware software provider could totally build and create. And as a purely a software provider, we're sort of at the whims of what the hardware providers can give to us in that way.
Right.
So it does present challenges, which is to say, like, there's nothing today that I think that would sort of get us to where we need to be in that space, but it is something that we're always looking at ways to sort of take advantage of and make the stuff that's in 1Password just more actionable. The vaccine passport thing is such a cool idea, because it's one of those things. It's like, if there were a standard that we could implement, like, we would be there. Like, with that, like, I mean, I'm not going to pre-announce
you're
a
almost
product,
there,
but like,
right? Yeah,
like we would love to be able to provide something like that.
So I guess it's part of my question too, because I don't have, you know, as a consumer of your product, you know, I have my own perception of how it's used and who uses it, but I have no idea about the kind of commercial conversations that you're having, or if you're having conversations with governments or with other places, again, that would, you know, really want to equip their citizens or their customers with, you know, secure credentials. I mean, there's, you know, the whole crypto space obviously is, and what's happening with Web3, I think is very relevant to what you guys are doing. You know, you guys use very similar, I don't know if it's the same cryptography, but the same approach where you have some sort of massive key or a seed phrase, and that's the thing that secures your account. And so anybody that gets a wallet in the crypto space suddenly, like, at least has sort of an adjacent comprehension of what 1Password kind of offers and provides and how it does it.
And so, by the way, I store all of those in 1Password, but go on.
Oh, right. Well, but exactly, right? So I guess I'm just trying to, like, you know, there's this 1Password 8 kind of early release thing, and, you know, that's a story, and we can talk about the underlying changes of Electron versus Swift UI, or, you know, using or moving away from Mac technologies. You know, people are going to have their sports teams, and they're going to, you know, want the Yankees or the Red Sox to win. That's fine. I guess I am more interested in the future of authentication and identity, because I've been in this space for so long, and you guys have too. So if you could give me any sense for where you see these opportunities and the conversations that you're having, that'd be really, really interesting.
I think Tabwallet came up so often, right? And we even had a blog post about how to use 1Password for cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to implement some levels, like some support there. But imagine doing that on 5 different platforms, right? And I think that's where it kind of stopped. Like, we started.
Well, isn't that true for MetaMask and like the other ones? Like, aren't they going to have to do the same? Or are you saying that they have less surface area to worry about because they're more focused just in the crypto context?
No, I'm just saying, if you want to do this on, we had 5, if you remember, before 1Password 8, we had 5 different teams working on different platforms, right? And every time we want to implement a new feature, we're like, okay, now we need to coordinate all these 5 teams. And just the amount of work basically stopped a lot of projects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, like, I guess, is that not also just the nature of building software in 2021?
Yeah.
I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. you're obviously closer to it.
That's kind of what we're, like, that's what we want to get away from, right? So, like, I would, as much as I, like, want to dive into, like, I'm gonna be a little bit of a frustrating guest because I'm not gonna answer your question directly, but instead I'm gonna twist it and answer it the way that I want to.
Perfect.
Which is to say that if we sort of like bring this back to like the whole like, you know, 1Password 8 and the platform thing, like this, it is the thing that I'm the most excited about is because of this 1Password core, because of the fact that like, yeah, we can affect change across all of our deployment platforms in one code base. It sets us up for those types of conversations and those types of like going out and solving those types of problems in a way that we just couldn't before, right? Like this is sort of that first step that level sets us, and it says, cool. Like now we don't have to worry.
Let me pause.
Go ahead.
Because I know what just happened, which is that I'm doing the thing that I normally do, which is like, cool. What's the next thing? And so first I will just sit and kind of acknowledge, you know, what 1Password 8 represents for you guys in terms of cohering around a strong core that then allows you to then even entertain those thoughts. Because in the previous world, prior to 8, like suddenly you have 5 teams that have to spin up and coordinate, and it's like a shit show. So it's like, how are we going to make this happen? And now it's like, well, we've come together, we have a common code base. Now this allows us to have the conversation that we weren't able to have before.
Yeah, and I'll even butt in there and say from like the business perspective, because I know Brian's a big fan of that.
And who owns this voice so people know who's talking?
Oh, sorry. So this is Andrew Beyer. I'm the lead of our browser experience here at 1Password.
Thank you.
So from a business perspective, one of the really interesting things, origin story about 1Password, is Dave and Rustam built this company up completely privately held. We had zero inside or outside investment for the first 12, 13 years of its lineage, right? And because of that, that did kind of prevent some of the scale up. So for a little bit of background history, I joined this company a little over 4 years ago, and I was about like around 50 employees at the time, and people were freaking out. They're like, holy cow, this is huge. This company's getting big, right? We are now in a little over 4 years pushing 500 employees, right? So we've scaled up in 4 years, 10x from an employee's perspective. So I can be completely honest and say there have been companies from the fintech space, from different spaces, who reached out to us in those earlier days and wanted to build integrations, and we were just like, whoa, there's no way we can support that right now, right? Like we're just not of that size, right? So one of the really interesting things about investment and growing the team is we actually do have some things in the pipeline now where we are integrating with other businesses, bringing new functionality to you directly within the app, within the browser. One example of that isn't like the all in becoming, we're going to re-roll all of authentication for the web, is our integration with privacy.com that we launched late last year. And that basically gives you the ability to create and store in 1Password these generated credit cards, virtual credit cards, directly as you're checking out, right? Mm. And that was a great example of a mutual partnership between 1Password and this other company, because let's be honest, like we're over here writing client apps, we're not spinning up fintech, we're not building a bank service, you know, we're headquartered in Canada, there's a lot of regulation around that. But what's cool about that is now where we're super strong, which is we're built into, you know, your digital life, we can now offer companies like Privacy the ability to have their service built directly into 1Password, you know, right as you're signing up and creating that generated password, you can now generate a virtual credit card, fill that on the page, and go about your business. And it, as an added benefit, you can now store that credit card in 1Password, access that CVV verification number later. And it really kind of, I know Brian recently talked about the friction of checkout, right, on one of the Tech Meme podcasts. Like, we helped eliminate the friction of checkout. And that's the kind of areas where we are going to be able to really push after with this foundation and with as we scale and as we build this incredible organization.
Yeah, I just said that I use 1Password to fill in my credit cards. I used to memorize my credit card numbers, and I haven't.
What?
It's did.
Like remembering like phone numbers.
I used to do it. But.
I understand. Well, okay, so I had a quick question on this, and then we can probably wrap up pretty soon. One of the things you just said, I think, is important, and we really didn't even talk about it, because we've talked so much about the authentication piece, the software piece, but like the fintech world is on fire. And the fact that there is more of this movement to virtual credit cards, you know, and essentially bringing some of the, you know, credential best practices to, I guess, you know, financial credentials, like it seems like 1Password is well positioned to sort of be like your one credit card. So how do you think about, I guess, maybe verticals that are relevant from a business perspective? You know, and Andrew, I'm specifically interested in your perspective. You know, you guys took this investment from Accel, and I'm sure that they're awesome to work with. They have a bunch of portfolio companies. It just feels like there's a strategic opportunity there for you guys to, you know, as they said in their blog post, to kind of really try to own that space. And the question I have is like, well, what is that space and how do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that question great, but I will say that like one of the reasons why we partnered with Accel wasn't really to get the money. It was to access all of the companies that they work with, right? So yeah, we brought them on as a board of directors. The first investment was somewhere around like 18 months ago or so. And as you can imagine, like these things take a bit of time to build those relationships, get those kind of future plans in place, and then really launch a new product with it, right? And what's funny is like, we kind of, the reason why we trended on Twitter was, and we keep harping on it, right? And Rustam and I are keep harping on it. It's like, we just built the foundation, right? Like we built the Slack of 1Password. Now we are building all of the Slack apps or the 1Password apps that will connect in and allow you to access all of those. And one of the great things we get out of working with someone like Accel is they have a ton of these companies that they work with and that they've back, and they've been setting up those relationships for us and allowing us to explore the next really big thing. And when we build the next really big thing, it will be consistent. It will be delivered cross-platform, mobile, desktop, web, everywhere. And that's one of the places where 1Password is really greatly positioned in this market, right? There's not a lot of people that have a lot of browser extensions, but if you're a 1Password user, you're guaranteed to have that integrated into your browser. Even Apple announced web extensions in iOS 15 and iPadOS 15, so we're going to be there. We're going to be able to bring these services that may not build something that would directly connect into your browser. We're bringing that capability to them, and we're bringing that capability to our users.
Yeah, okay. So I am trying to close this, but like you just brought up something that I think is super relevant, super important, and also one that's just not a conversation that we get to talk a lot about, which is the extension piece of this. Because there's a constant question about antitrust and about the extensibility of software, about things like app stores and, you know, the control over those. You guys have made a very successful business being probably one of the most downloaded and installed extensions across all the different browsers. You know, you live and die based on those extension, you know, rules. And, you know, historically, extensions can be really, really insecure and problems, you know, cause lots of problems for browsers. I guess it does seem, on the other hand, you guys have surfed that wave or set of waves really effectively. And are one of the few businesses that really kind of builds atop of browsers. Does that, you know, or is that any concern for the future? I mean, the web seems to be moving towards APIs and sort of point-to-point integrations, but you guys live on top of the browser experience itself. So do you expect that to continue to evolve, especially on mobile?
Well, that's a really good question. And I would say like 2 years ago, I'd have a different answer. I do want to quickly say, I forgot to interject. We did actually add support for Sidekick. It's even in 1Password 7 beta, by the way.
It just broke today. So I filed a bug on your community forum. But yes, I really appreciated when it was there. And now it's gone. Now I feel the pain. So but yes, yeah, you have my feedback.
So actually integrating with browsers, I think, was a fear at one point. It's a kind of an interesting back history where Dave and Rustam were actually like swizzling Safari and injecting their code before CodeSign was a thing.
I remember that.
Running in the browser,
that was right? A pretty like, big hack, right? Nobody can build a business like this.
They were literally hacking the browser and adding in just random code to get 1Password rolling, right? So we have been in the browser extension game before there were browser extensions, which is kind of a fun, like,
it's like you invented the category,
right? Mm-hmm. Right. But I will say, like, so, you know, we were concerned at certain times, right? Like Apple kind of were killing off extensions as we saw it. But last year they launched web extensions, which is the common API shared between Chromium based browsers, Firefox, and now Safari. Huge. And they just announced in the last year that they're bringing this now to iPhone and iPadOS. And I'll be honest, it's like everything. There's a lot of places where I think there can be improvement. We have a lot of, you know, we're working on it every day to try to make it better. But I mean, I wouldn't say that Apple would be going all in on this bet and talking about it at WWDC if they were planning on killing web extensions in the next year or two, right? And to add to that point, there's actually Apple and Google and the W3C just launched a web extensions community group, which is basically an open community that anybody can join. Many members from 1Password are there. There's people from Firefox. There's people from even our competitors that are there trying to basically build the foundation for the very next version of the web extensions API. So there's a heck of a lot of investment from Google, Apple, Microsoft, Mozilla, like all of the big names. We literally have to work with all of them, but they're all kind of coming together to set that next big web extension web standard. So we're feeling pretty safe there. And then, of course, you know, worst case, you're using Sidekick. You know, there could always be a 1Password browser, right? Like there's always options if the extension area gets shut down.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, guys, this is super helpful, super useful. I really appreciate you guys all being game for this, you know, for taking some of my salty comments, which, you know, is normally where I start, and then I kind of like, you know, unravel a bit. You guys did get, you know, you pissed off the internet, but I feel like it's a lot of the trend lately is like, oh, there's something that happened and I wasn't consulted and therefore I'm angry. And then like you learn a little more and, you know, you guys seem like you're in pretty good spirits. This is the last question I'll ask, which is, what is your impression of the response, right? Like, my sense is that you guys see this and you're like, wow, that's weird. Like, why are you guys all freaking out? But I'd love to hear it from you. You know, you see this and you see some of the feedback. What are people getting wrong? What do you think, you know, is right in the criticism so far?
I think everyone should answer that, but I'll add mine real quickly. But I think Rue and Rustam probably have different feelings about it. Essentially, I knew exactly that this was going to happen, right? Like, I complain about Electron apps being slow sometimes on my machine. The difference is which Electron app it is, right? Mm-hmm. So I use VS Code every day. It's been built on Electron. It's backed by Microsoft. It's an incredible app. And the truth of the matter is we've built this 1Password headless client. We can really swap out any UI front end that we want in the future. It just so happens that web UI is the cross-platform UI platform of choice right now. And Electron just happens to be the vessel for getting kind of our native backend and our web front end on every platform. And the industry's borne this out, right? Like, we all use Slack. Even Apple uses Slack, right? Most of the Apple commentators that are going to talk about this in the news, they're going to be discussing 1Password using Electron on an Electron app, right? Like, the hypocrisy aside, like, literally, Slack is one of the best, most used desktop apps of this decade. And 1Password is going to be the most used, best Electron app of next decade. And I'm personally extremely happy about that. And I can't wait to see the future.
I'm going to a big AI startup demo day here in the city tomorrow, and I will 100% be decked out in Mack Weldon clothing. Why? Well, Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. That's their AirKnit underwear. Crazy, comfortable, but elevated sweatpants, the Ace Collection. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads, the Silver Peak Polo. That's my personal fave. And ultra-soft antimicrobial tees for when you need to stay fresh longer. Their silver crewneck t-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code RIDE.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
That's a great answer.
Drew?
Yeah, much the same in terms of like I think we knew that this was coming, right? We knew that publishing a one password app wrapped up in Electron was going to hit our fan base, and I will say fan base like pretty hard, right? This is a pretty strong left turn from how we built our apps in the past, and yeah, it was something that we sort of saw coming. The piece that I'm hoping to get to is sort of past the gut reactions and into the meat of it, because we still, even though this is the tech stack that we've chosen for this particular app, like, we still want to build great Mac apps. So like, and we're going to try and do so on this platform. And I think that knowing where we've fallen short is the thing that I want to hear the most from people, because we're at that point, or at least I know I'm at that point now, where I've been living with this app and using this app for so long that like, it's normalized for me at this point. So we need those fresh eyes. We need those people to tell us like, hey, like, you got this part wrong. This needs to be better, so we can actually iterate and make it better and ship something to stable that like people are happy about and people love.
So Rue, I want to hear from you on this just qualifying question, I guess, which is, it seemed to me that there was almost like a spiritual element to this response. In other words, like when I saw it, you know, and I was like, oh, it's Electron. It was like, oh, there's another great Mac app that's, you know, gone the way of the web and needs to be cross-platform, because that's what the business world kind of needs. And so in a way, it sort of felt like this, I don't know, like little bit of an abandonment of where you came from. And I, you know, I think what you just said was useful and good, which is that our expectations of these web apps and these Electron apps is sufficiently low because of the way in which people often build these things and they don't optimize them. I think that, and I guess maybe I'd like to hear from you, you know, you're obviously betting, you know, more or less the company on this new direction. Should people be concerned about that? And should they worry about, you know, losing some of these Mac roots and replacing them with something more of the web?
So I'm going to tell you another story.
Okay.
And I know that we're running long and I apologize, but this also, it's a good story. So when we started this project back at the beginning of last year, we said, okay, like we're doing file new project on all of our apps. Okay, what does that mean? Well, Linux has a ton of different windowing environments. We're not building native Linux apps, like native UI Linux apps, where we're going to use GNOME and, you know, all the different possible Linux permutations of UI. We're going to build an Electron app there. We're going to build an app with web UI there, and we're going to package it with Electron, and that's what we're going to ship. That'll be fine. All right, what about Windows? Well, Windows has proven to us to be a bit of a struggle to hit the UX that we want to hit using the toolkits that come available to build native UI in Windows. So let's take and we'll ship web UI there, and let's go ahead and we'll wrap that in Electron. That's fine. Good, we'll do that. What about on Mac? Well, Mac, we've always had a history of building native Mac apps. So let's try for that. Like, let's do that. But part of this project was consolidating our efforts a bit. So we had a huge amount of consolidation in the core already, fine. But we also wanted to consolidate our front ends too. Even though they're thin, we didn't want to be writing a whole bunch of different front ends. So we said, let's bet on Swift UI. Let's try it. We're going to build a Swift UI Mac app, and that will share a whole bunch of UI with the iOS apps that we're building. Like,
that's honestly what I would have expected. So I'm very curious to hear this. Yeah.
So, okay, great. We're going to do that. And listen, there's a little bit of hubris in this. Okay. I think there's a lot of hubris in a company rewriting all their apps anyway. But anyway, we said, okay, like we're going to build a Swift UI Mac app. It's going to have to target relatively modern OSs to take advantage of the new Swift UI stuff in order to be good enough.
We can't do that though. Like, we can't set our minimum requirements to just be Big Sur for the new app, because people keep their Macs for a lot longer. They just, we need to be able to cover a broader range of OSs. That's okay. We'll use the Electron app on Mac as well to cover the OSs that the native app doesn't. So we can check all the boxes for the platforms that we need to hit, but we also know how important it is to people that we build a native Mac app, and they're probably going to be on the latest stuff anyway. Let's go ahead and do that. And like, cool. We went to town, we started building this thing, and it was great. Like, you know, having a lot of fun, having a lot of challenges with Swift UI and learning stuff and everything else. And we hit a point earlier this year. Time's a blur. We hit a point and where we said, like, okay, like, what are we really doing though? Like, how are we actually going to get these things to finish? How are we going to ship this? How are we not going to confuse people by, like, which one they're supposed to download? Like, are we putting our effort in the wrong spot? Like, should we just pull back from this a little bit? And it honestly, it was a hard conversation. It was like, we struggled with this for a while. We said, like, listen, like, and it was at that point we said, like, look, if we are only shipping an app that is packaged with Electron on Mac, like, people are probably going to lose their minds when they see this. And so, like, we weren't wrong there. But ultimately, like, it was sort of like a nexus event of a lot of things coming together. Like, we could have said, fine, we're going to pivot and build an AppKit app, but that didn't fit with, like, us wanting to consolidate the front end languages that we were using. So ultimately, like, we made the decision to go and build, to go all in on the web UI on the desktop and say, like, look, we're going to do this. And it allows us to, you know, of course we get the benefits of, like, a cross-platform experience that the same features that we're bringing to the Mac, we're also bringing to Linux and Windows at the exact same time. But then you look at sort of, you know, we certainly did, and I hope that it starts to show through, especially as the early access goes on. It's like, what things make this special? What make a Mac app special, right? Like, if you look at this app, one of the things we added just a couple weeks ago was the fact that it's got that translucent sidebar that all new Mac apps have, right? That, we didn't do that because it was easy, because it wasn't. But like, we're like, this would be really cool if we could bring this, like, you know, this thing that makes, one of the things that makes a Mac app look like a Mac app. Like, let's see if we can bring it to our app. And we did. So like, it was not an easy decision to make. We're still building a native iOS app, right? Like, that's one that, when it comes out later this year, I'm hoping that the reception on that early access day is a little bit better. But you know, like, this is where we are today. We're doing the best we can. I think we've done really well so far with it, and I'm excited to see where we take it from here.
Awesome. Well, I mean, that's a great note to end on. Thank you for that story as well. I mean, I think, like, it's just, there's, I don't know if I want to call it, like, bad faith, but there is this sense that, like, oh, you know, they should have known, like, Electron doesn't work. And it's like, of course they do. Like, there's trade-offs in all of this. And it's really, really hard, of course, when you know, first come upon information to have any sense for how much someone did or didn't think about all the issues that, you know, you personally care the most about. And because we don't live in, there's not a real kind of democracy in software development, you know, where people can, you know, vote, although, you know, that's the crypto world. It does feel like, you know, people have this immediate reaction that says, I don't trust you to do a good job. And I think there needs to be these kind of conversations that, you know, bring in and open up more of these, I mean, literal spaces to have these conversations, to get your perspective, to see what the constraints are, to see what the trade-offs are. And then to think about how much you guys have had to think about it, and also think about, you know, the amount of resources that you have. You know, do you really want to, you know, grow from 5 to 1,000 people just to be able to support, you know, a Swift UI app or something? Like, probably not. So, anyways,
we are extremely fortunate to have such a passionate fan base. That is the big takeaway from this, right?
Like, yes.
We made Twitter trending without having some wild controversy about our founders or CEO of the company, right? Our Twitter trending is over
Electron.
You know what I mean? So, like, that is a testament to how passionate our users are, and we are incredibly fortunate And we are incredibly fortunate to be a company to actually be involved in that community and listen. Like, for example, one of the things we did as part of this rewrite is our security team actually wrote a package to make Electron apps more secure, to harden them after they're built. And we got to contribute that back to the community.
What is that one called for people that want to check that out?
It's on our GitHub repo. It's on github.com/1password. It should be pinned up there if you don't find it. But I think it's called like Electron Hardener or something like that. So
obvious.
Yeah, definitely check that out because, yeah, definitely Electron-Hardener. It is basically if you are like us and you want to build, take a Rust library, build an Electron app, you run this tool and it will make your app more secure, right? Like that is obviously a core fundamental of what we're doing here at 1Password. Even though I've heard honeypot and viruses mentioned in various conversations here, I would say like we do have the best security policies, practices, and you know trust from our users with regard to security and privacy. And so one of the technical challenges was, can we make an Electron app that can give us the security guarantees that we require? And we were able to do that, and not only that, contribute back to the community.
Got it.
And on top of that, too, we also have Electron Secure Defaults, which is a starter project that can get you started with Electron so that it has a lot of those secure defaults turned on by, default. And another talk from our product lead, Mitchell Cohen, which went up at one of the conferences this year to talk about the ways that we harden Electron as so that we can ship the most secure version of 1Password.
Wow. Well, this is also great news. So if people want to find this, I assume I'm looking at it right now, they can go to blog.1Password.com, but is there another place where they can go find out more about 1Password 8, or is it the best resource right now?
Sorry, go to the blog. Yeah.
The blog is good.
Okay. I went into listener mode for a minute. I was like, oh, yeah, I wonder what people are going to say.
Is this a podcast or am I on a Squarespace?
No, that is one of the cool things, right? Like, this is the very first version of a fully flushed out, rewritten app. So, like, of course there's going to be a few bugs here or there, but the level of polish we put into essentially what is the first beta version you can get is really outstanding.
It does look really good. And I noticed there's a little bug, a little ladybug icon in the top right of the app, and so I presume that's the best place to send feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. You can file kind of issue, or you can get directly into our feedback and kind of submit either through our forums, which we still have because we've been a software company for a decade and a half. We have a community forum. Diehard users love it, but we also just have a regular contact form on 1Password.com that you can kind of submit kind of issues and we'll get those prioritized in.
I got it. All right, guys, this was amazing. Thank you for staying on super long. I appreciate everyone here who's also been listening to this entire conversation. If you guys want to follow the speakers, I highly recommend it. You know, reach out. They're not going to bite. They're open for your feedback as well. Rue, Sam, Andrew, Nick, Michael, I think that's all the speakers today. Brian, of course, really appreciate you guys showing up for another episode of the TechMeme Ride Home Experience. We will probably get this out, if not tomorrow, this weekend. But really appreciate you guys showing up and putting in all this effort to help us understand what you guys are working on and get us excited about the future that you guys are building. So thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Cheers. Yeah, thanks for having us. It was really fun.
Thank you.
Last time I talked to Brian, we were talking about e-bikes on Twitter, and his wife was butting and saying no. So I've been wanting to talk to him with my voice for a while now. So
thank you, Andrew.
I'm really thankful to have this conversation.
Well, and by the way, you're right. The stories that I love the most are the stories of companies that go 14 years before they even have to take outside capital. Like, I am one of your fans, so keep doing what you're doing, guys.